recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it or downloading it to your iPod or whatever type of player you have. Today we have an excellent show on evaluating electronically stored information on home computers. This is a show I really enjoy doing because my panelist, Keith Altman, suggested we do this show, and that spares me some of the effort of having to think of new shows every week, and I'm all for that. So let me introduce the advocate for the show. Keith Altman is an attorney with Finkelstein and Partners, Mass Torts Department, and he specializes in pharmaceutical litigation. After consulting on several major pharmaceutical litigations since 1996, Keith was admitted to the Bar of California in 2008. Some of the litigation matters he's worked on include diet drugs, Rezolin, Prepulsid, Accutane, Laramin, hormone therapy, Neurontin, Lyrica, Avandia, Meridia, Viagra, and Ortho-Evra. Keith is also an expert in electronic discovery and is the founder of the American Association of Justice Electronic Discovery Litigation Group. He's also a member of the Working Group 1 of the Sedona Conference on Electronic Discovery and is a member of several drafting teams. Keith has lectured throughout the United States on electronic discovery issues. He has a B.S. magna cum laude in astronomy physics from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And while working there, he worked on several research projects as well as in a lab conducting experiments in quantum electronics. Keith has done extensive software development for data analysis and litigation support tools and is a past guest on a previous ESI Byte show, and we always like having past guests back. So, Keith, thanks for joining us on the show, and why don't we just start off first by asking, why did you want to do the show?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening as most households have home computers these days, it's becoming an issue of whether there is documents that are responsive to litigation sitting on home computers. And we all use computers for a lot of different things, business purposes, personal purposes. And a lot of times we put very, private personal information on our computers. And the discovery of information on computers opens up a whole set of issues that really require very careful management. And as litigations are moving more into the electronic age, you see more and more requests for information from home computers coming from both sides, whether it's a private plaintiff or it's directed at employees of a corporation. And so it seemed to me that this is a very important topic to discuss.
Why might a party want to look at another party's home computer? I mean, what can you get access to there that you can't get otherwise?
Well, there's two sides to that coin. From a corporate perspective, a lot of people do work for their business on their home computers. They may take a document home and edit it. They may do work on their computer. They may leave the corporation and still have corporate information on their home computers. So from a corporate perspective, there may be information that may not exist anywhere on the corporate network but may exist on somebody's home computer. From the private party side, let's say a plaintiff in a personal injury lawsuit, there's potentially, information discussing their injuries. They could have emails where maybe they've discussed their injuries with people other than their, healthcare professionals, and maybe there are some inconsistencies. There may also be information that can give some insight into the state of mind of the person if there is some psychological injury alleged. And so it's not inconceivable that it would make sense to review certain information on somebody's home computer.
Well, looking at a home computer seems to be an art form. As my first read on a number of the cases I've looked at in this area, courts are really loath to grant unfettered access to someone's home computer. So generally, what do you need to show to get around that barrier to make an argument to win that argument to get to someone's home computer?
Well, let's talk about the difference between, let's say, a business computer and a home computer, because that's really what changes the game. A business computer presumably is used for business purposes. In general, most of the time, a business computer is only used by one employee. And there's often policies within the corporation that says personal information that's on a business computer is not not protected, not confidential, although there's a growing body of law questioning that concept. But putting that, you know, putting that aside, essentially going at a business computer, you're just not likely to find a huge amount of personal information about other people. Now, putting looking at a home computer, the problem is that very often a home computer is shared by multiple users, many of which may not even be a party to the lawsuit. Home computers tend to have a lot of information that may be completely irrelevant to the lawsuit, even if it's, you know, the sole use of a particular person, your purchasing habits, things like that, that may not be relevant. So there is likely to be a lot of information on there that is does not belong to the individual who's a party, or is really truly not relevant. And one of the problems is that, and then on top of that, you're dealing with a lot of information on there that may not have even been created by the individuals that are using the computer, system files, system access files, and things like that. And so to tease out and be assured that the information only belongs to somebody who is, you know, either a party or a, you know, a legitimate non-party witness, and getting relevant information is very, very difficult. So, coming back to your question, you really have to be very targeted in what you're asking for, and just ask, and just simply saying, "Give me your computer," is just not really a realistic approach. And so one of the ways that you need to get around that is really put some kind of an insulation between the requesting party and the producing party, and give the producing party the opportunity to comply with the requesting party's requests and have them manage the process of getting at the information and then delivering responsive documents, much as the way it's been done in every other context. It seems to be kind of strange. We wouldn't allow... a corporation wouldn't allow an opposing party in general to come in and sit and personally search their network, but yet they don't seem to have any problem saying, well, I want to be able to go in and search your client's home computer myself.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a lot of what we talked about in the database podcast we did of actually meeting, conferring, and discussing what do you have and how you're going to get at it, coming up with a strategy, applies here.
Yes, I think it's even more critical. I think it's even more critical here. And parties need to realize is that, you know, discovery requests are not really form dependent. You know, if information is responsive, it really doesn't matter what form it's in. So if I do in fact have information on my home computer that would be responsive to a legitimate request by a party, well, it's no more or less, you know, more or less discoverable than if I had, you know, a paper file. You know, it would be the exact same obligation. So, once again, the parties need to work together to really understand what the requests are, and number two, to come up with a fair way that, you know, is likely to separate out the non-responsive material from responsive, and to separate out the relevant, you know, information from relevant persons from those that is not relevant.
Before we go into actually how you'd attack the data in a fair way, a lot of times the sort of the battleground is set, and you know, an individual gets a request from the opposing side that we want to see your personal computer. And what do that what should that individual do who has a privacy concern? You know, I mean, Quan came out recently, and while not showing much about I mean, it shows how much dirt can show up when a device is looked at. I mean, it was a cell phone, not a personal computer. But it does show that this can be very personal and unflattering information sometimes that comes out.
Well, I think one of the key determining factors that needs to be considered is whether there's an expectation of a what I call a basic search of the computer or a forensic search. Let me explain the difference, and this will have a major impact. Basic search of the computer says you give me a discovery request, and I look in all the I look in all the reasonable places for me to look at information. I look in my standard word processing files. I look in documents that have been created by the user. Maybe I can pull up you know, some temporary files, and it's essentially something that can be done by a skilled, knowledgeable, you know, computer user. They can run search, you know, they can run searches within the Windows operating system, and it's really the analog of going through somebody's paper files, and you might have to sit down with the individual and go through that. A forensic search is something different, and that's where there is an attempt to search for things other than the active files. You're looking for deleted files. You're looking for file fragments. You're looking for, you know, just ghosts and whispers of information that could be on the computer. And to do a proper forensic search really requires somebody with, you know, a significant amount of knowledge and the appropriate set of tools. So if you're going to use the just do a basic search, then I think the parties can agree. You want me to do a basic search, I will respond and give you appropriate documents. And I think there's nothing more that the requesting party really, really can or should be able to do about that. I mean, parties are entitled to manage their own requests. I often say when I get the requests coming towards me that they want to come in and get my clients on computer, I ask, do I get to sit on your client's network and go through their computer? And, of course, that would be an inconceivable thought. Well, it's a two-way street on that. Now, when you get with the forensic search, that's a much different animal that really requires more management. Very often, the requesting party will say, well, I'll go ahead and bring in my independent neutral expert who'll go in and capture the drive and provide responsive materials. And that opens up a host of problems, because if they're providing the expert, that doesn't necessarily make that person a neutral expert. But one of the things that has to be in place, regardless of who actually does the forensic search, is there has to be a process by which potentially discoverable material is given to the producing party, giving them an opportunity to review and see what is privileged, what is responsive, and then produce the appropriate material to the requesting party. There can be no contact between the requesting party and the forensic examiner. That has to be a complete wall between that process. Now, that doesn't mean that in the appropriate circumstances that it might not be necessary to examine the forensic examiner or put them up for a deposition or even have them testify at trial, but there can't be any direct contact. There can be no communications once whatever search protocol is set. So that's how that really can be managed. And then in general, you know, it's less of a concern who actually does the forensic search as long as there is this absolute wall between the requesting party and the examiner once the protocols are set.
So is this almost like a third party, we have all these opportunities and formats that are coming together with special masters or e-mediators or, you know, people that are trying to facilitate the process. And is this just another example of a technical person coming in?
Sure. But one thing that's very important is that certain law firms may, in fact, have the technical expertise in-house to do the appropriate forensic examination of the computer. And if that is, in fact, true, then they're entitled to use their in-house person. I mean, there's no reason why a party should have to go out and hire an outside individual to go and do this. Hello? Are we still on?
Yeah, we're still on.
Okay, sorry about that. There's no reason to go out and hire an outside individual unless they don't possess the expertise in-house to manage it. And this is sometimes can be a subject of debate, but frankly, parties, once again, are entitled to responsively comply with the discovery demands. It's no different than, requesting party saying, I get to pick your e-discovery vendor because I don't trust who you're going to use in-house to do the work.
Okay. One last thing just to make it clear about it almost seems like it's more the norm than the exception that home computers are used at least for some tangential business purpose. In a world driven by the cloud, you know, computers just like a telephone. You know, the data is located somewhere accessible, and you're using a home computer to access a work data location. So, do you think this is something that should be dealt with all the time, right up front in the meet and confer?
Well, I think it's certainly something that is should be dealt with. First of all, you know, I think the from a preservation perspective, the parties need to discuss what level of preservation should be required for home computers that may be that may have responsive material. You know, once again, there's a difference between preservation and production. And so, for example, the parties need to discuss upfront, is there any expectation of forensic examination of the computer? If there's not an expectation of forensic examination of the computer, then, you know, perhaps a simple backup through some basic backup software along with a instruction not to you know, delete any information and an explanation of what, you know, is responsive may be adequate. If there's going to be a forensic examination, then obviously you need to consider forensic preservation. And that really should be discussed up front. But I think part of what goes along with that is the party should discuss, you know, then need to discuss who's potentially going to have responsive information on their home computers. And, you know, I think it's fairly obvious that, you know, the plaintiff in a personal injury case, you know, will likely, and we think it's a good idea that, you know, all counsel, you know, representing individuals instruct their clients to take steps to do a reasonable preservation right out of the box. I mean, it's no different than a business. You know, at least send a directive to them. They may not be very sophisticated. Send a directive to them not to delete things. Then the parties need to discuss if there's going to be a forensic examination versus a basic examination. That really should be discussed up front at the meet and the confer, and you plan this out. But so the answer is absolutely yes. You need to discuss this at the meet and confer.
Okay. One of the things that I remember, you know, when eDiscovery first started, you would have these situations where a party would hand off their paper and there'd be no emails. And, you know, you'd scratch your head and say, of course there have to be some emails. but sometimes that would fly through. People wouldn't challenge that. Do you think if there's no data produced at all that comes from a home computer, that's at least worth a question?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, there is one thing that's kind of a unique situation with a home computer, which is many home computers do not use a email management system that's stored on the computer, such as Outlook or Outlook Express. A lot of people use Yahoo or Gmail or things like that, where they don't actually maintain the emails on their home computer, and that creates a whole different set of problems where they don't technically have that information in their control. And if they're to some degree subject to, you know, a third-party ISP to maintain the email. So, yes, when there's no information produced, it is certainly worthy of an inquiry as to at least, you know, what did you do to go and, you know, search for the information on the computer. And getting back to the meet and confer, I think it's very important to establish, you know, that this person is using, you know, non-computer managed email.
You know, one other question I want to ask in this area. I've had a couple meetings with people that have been tied into some large companies where they've been experimenting with cost-cutting measures. Everyone's looking for cost-cutting measures these days. And one proposal was to let employees purchase their own computers with a cash stipend from the employer. And, you know, what do you think this does to eDiscovery, everything we've talked about here?
Well, I think it, you know, I think individuals need to understand that it technically exposes their information, you know, inquiries of their information on their home computer. And, you know, if they use this computer, it would seem to be the implication in doing that is the expectation that the person, unlike in the office where there may be some restrictions on using the machine for personal purposes, there may be less or no restrictions on this home computer stipend issue. So, therefore, we may see some issues that go along with that. You know, one of the things that's very important is to understand, and this is part of the meet and confer process, is the existence of information that may not exist anywhere else within a centralized network. When we do a general electronic discovery issues, you know, there may be access to the network, and that's fine, but to what extent can people store information on some other place other than the network that there may be no other copy of that information. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of backing up. You know, if that machine is being used for business purposes, one would think that information should be backed up more regularly than might be done if it was just a basic personal computer. The reality of the situation is that people are terrible about backing up their home computers, and every day people lose large amounts of information because they didn't take the time to run a backup, and it's a bad habit that everybody's gotten into. And then, of course, there's the problem, what happens when an individual leaves the corporation? What steps are the corporate, you know, this could be a corporate problem. What steps is the corporation going to take to ensure that all of its business asset information is returned to it and not maintained on that computer? And from a corporate perspective, they're potentially exposing themselves to some situations where, for example, you know, one of the questions I'm going to ask is, what was the policy for ensuring that the company, you know, acquired all of its information from an employee who left the corporation? And if not, and if the company doesn't take steps, they may very well have bought some responsibility for going out and talking to previous employees and trying to collect that information. So, I, you know, as a general proposition, I think it's a good idea for every corporation to ask, you know, for any business to ask anybody that leaves the corporation to certify that they have returned all the business information to the corporation, that they haven't retained anything that they're not supposed to have, and that the corporation has taken basic steps to secure that information. Now, of course, an employee may not be truthful or may not remember, and that's a different situation, but not taking that simple basic step is very problematic for a corporation.
You know, two other related areas I sort of wanted to move into, they go off of your answer of, you're really looking for information that's not accessible elsewhere. And, you know, one that we talked about before the start of the show was, you know, Facebooking and friending. And I think there's some analogies to the types of information that, you know, or some of the privacy concerns with a home computer. You want to talk a little bit about that auto accident case we were talking about with friending?
Sure. You know, I was rather shocked to get a call a couple of months ago about from an attorney where he is representing an individual who was involved in a car accident, where the defense lawyer brought an actual motion for an order requiring that the private individual friend the defense counsel, so the defense counsel had access to her Facebook page. And I found that to be rather shocking that somebody would actually bring that motion. Now, we have to dissect what's going on there. In the first place, there very well could be responsive information that somebody keeps on their Facebook page. You know, once again, people will talk about their feelings and what's going on and how they're hurting and things like that with other individuals. And if there's information like that on a Facebook page, that clearly is, you know, may very well be responsive. But there's also information from other individuals that have nothing to do with this particular individual that may be talking about their own personal situations. And so to provide unfettered access to an opposing counsel to somebody's Facebook page is, frankly, you know, just not reasonable. Now, there's also been cases where people have surreptitiously, you know, gotten friended, and I think there's some ethics issues that may not be pass ethical muster if you misrepresent who you are in order to get access to somebody's Facebook page. So I think that the right way to handle it is frankly to make a legitimate discovery request for information that responsive information that may be stored on the Facebook page, and just like the general issue, the responding party goes to the Facebook page, finds the responsive information to the extent that it exists, and produces it just like anything else. And I think that would meet the goal of the lawyer who was looking to get information off the Facebook page, but yet still protect the privacy of individuals who have nothing to do with the litigation.
Similarly, and this is a question I get a lot, is, people use cell phones to text all the time, and, you know, lines blur between personal and business, because it's a very efficient tool to send a quick text. And, you know, what do you see happening in that area in terms of the same arguments, but getting access to that information, in particular when it's held by a third party, you know, the large phone companies that host these types of services?
Well, first of all, let's talk about putting aside whether the information is maintained by a third party. The whole concept of social media has really created a significant quandary that people have not really resolved. And I can tell you, just having been at the mid-year meeting of the Sedona Conference on Electronic Discovery, it is the subject of much discussion and much debate of what to do about it. And nobody has really good answers because, you know, if we preserve the information the way that maybe it should be preserved, it would make the use of the information so oppressive that nobody would want to do it. And when the legal requirements to use something get in the way of the use of the thing, that gets to be a problem. We're always trying to balance those two issues together. So it's just a very bad problem that nobody's got a really good answer to. But once again, similar to first of all, let's talk about a preservation issue. It's a real problem. How do I preserve stuff, you know, on my cell phone? What steps do I reasonably need to take in order to preserve stuff on my, you know, cell phone once I'm involved in a litigation? I don't have good answers to that. And just as a general proposition, we kind of try to have a detente that says we're not going after their people's cell phones, they're not going after our cell phones, and kind of it's brushed under the table because nobody really has a good way to deal with it that doesn't make it unusable. Now, to the extent that a third party may in fact maintain some of the information, I think the discoverability is kind of the same as just the home computer. I think as a general proposition, if there is, if a third party maintains the information, whether it's emails, whether it's social media, whether it's, cell phone records or text messages or whatever, I think the proper way to deal with it is if there's a legitimate discovery, request. If the information is obtainable from the third party, the request goes out to the third party, and the response goes to the producing party, who has an opportunity to review it for privacy issues and responsive and privileged issues, and produces it just like anything else. So once again, it's that same. As long as there is no connection between the third party and the requesting party, I think that's a totally legitimate, fair game, fair way to do things.
Well, this is it's always interesting to sort of end the show into an area where there are really no answers except common sense and do the best you can and realize litigation is imperfect. Concepts of proportionality and are always going to apply. But I appreciate you raising this topic. Is there anything else you wanted to add? I know you were talking about one particular case at the beginning that you might want to add, throw a couple things in. But
just a couple of follow-on concepts that I think are important. One is the costs associated with the examination of home computers, and this is a real issue. We talked a little bit earlier about the difference between a basic search, which I think is the responsibility of the producing party, and then there's the concept of a forensic search, which is a whole different level, and that gets into questions of reasonably accessible information is probably the subject of a lot of debate and for another time. But putting that aside, is the question is who pays the cost of a forensic examination? We have taken the position, and this is a two-way street, that the costs of a basic search are the responsibility of the producing party, as they have always been. The cost differential between that and a forensic search is really the cost of the requesting party. And so we've said to people, look, we'll do the basic search, and we'll get you response material. We pay for that. If you want a forensic search, we estimate that it would cost us, whatever it is, $500 or $750 for us to do an a reasonable search of the client's computer. If you want a forensic search, you pay whatever the cost difference. We'll pay the first $750. You pay whatever the cost is. I don't think a producing party has really a legitimate basis to object to a forensic search if the requesting party is willing to, effectively make the cost differential zero. And I think they would probably successfully be able to convince a court of that. So that's just a very important issue. And then the other thing is that be very careful the kind of orders that you ask for. A very important case is the case of John B., which was federal case in Tennessee, where effectively the court had ordered that a individual, along with the special master from the plaintiffs, were able to go into the governor of Tennessee's house and see, you know, effectively seize his home computer and do a forensic examination of it themselves. And the governor was a defendant. And that's about as invasive a situation as you could get. And while it was great to get the order, the Court of Appeals, the appellate court, decided that this was just an unreasonable invasion of privacy. So one of the things to consider is just because you may be able to get an order that gives you the kind of unfettered access, it may not be a good idea to do that. And it's probably, if there is a reasonable way for you to be separate, you know, have this wall between you and the people actually obtaining the information, and there is reasonable skills in being able to provide the information, it's much better to keep that separation and not get into those battles, because I think you're going to start to see real problems if you try to push that issue.
So strategically, be prepared for an appeal and try to do something so that even if you're going to win your argument, that you'll win at the next battle, which will be at the appellate level.
Correct, correct.
So, great. Well, those are good points. Keith, thanks for joining us here on the show, and keep proposing topics to talk about. As for anyone else that's listening, I'm always up for that, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes. Of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.